Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Hurricane Matthew bears down. The VP debate, U.S.-Russia relations get stormy. As the big wind came, Florida Governor Rick Scott urged 1.5 million Floridians on the coast to leave their homes.
Evacuate, evacuate, evacuate. This storm will kill you.
The U.S. and Russia stop talking peace in Syria, and things get huffy in a hurry. John Kerry.
Together, the Syrian regime and Russia seem to have rejected diplomacy in furtherance of trying to pursue a military victory.
And the vice presidential candidates, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, clashed in their one and only debate.
You've got to err on the side of the safety and security of the American people, Senator. I understand.
By trashing all Syrians or trashing all Muslims.
Senator Kaine, let me ask you this.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Youssef, Mark Murray, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you in Hurricane Matthew's path? Have you evacuated? Are you planning to? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Nancy Youssef, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast, longtime Middle East correspondent. Nancy, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Mark Murray, senior political editor for NBC News. Mark, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Mark.
All right. There was that debate. Pence steadying the boat for the Trump campaign there. Kaine on the attack. Here was a little bit of the sparring when Tim Kaine talked about insults made by Donald Trump.
When Donald Trump says women should be punished, or Mexicans are rapists and criminals,
I'm telling
or John
you.
McCain's not a hero, he is showing you who he is.
Senator, you whipped out that Mexican thing again.
Mark Murray, that was the beginning of the week. Here we are, end of the week. What's the lasting resonance impact? Is there one of the vice presidential debate?
If there is a lasting resonance, it is that there's still so many unanswered questions from Donald Trump's, I would argue, last rough 10 days of the campaign. Mike Pence had a very tough task in that vice presidential debate, was having to defend all the controversies over the past week, and whether it was Donald Trump's dust-up with Alicia Machado, some of the questions that you still had in the debate, the tax returns, the New York Times investigation into Donald Trump's 1995 return, all made things incredibly tough for Mike Pence. Given that, he did about as good of a job as you would end up expecting him to do, but still, so many of those stories do live on. They will be fodder at Sunday's debate, the second debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And so I do think you are probably right that you ended up stopping maybe some of the Clinton momentum from that Pence performance, but so many of those tough questions, so many of those controversies still live on, and that's going to be very tough for Donald Trump on Sunday.
Jack Beatty, what did you think of this meeting? Peggy Noonan, watching Tim Kaine, says his strategy was clear, block all thought, reduce everything to prefabricated one-liners. She said he has a weird, ungrown-up regard for the power of sarcasm. His antics kept the debate from developing into a series of thoughts that could be understood and absorbed. Pretty tough there. I mean, he kept punching Trump. The interruption flag got thrown at him during and after. What did you think of this meeting, Jack?
Yes, he interrupted something like 79 times. On the other hand, his claims, according to the Associated Press, were 79% accurate, truthful, whereas Pence was about 30% accurate or truthful. Pence allowed Republicans and conservatives to have something novel, really, the voice of a true conviction conservative. They haven't heard it from Trump. And you heard the familiar, but to conservatives, very important phrases, partial birth abortion. We heard about the trammels of Washington bureaucrats and regulation stifling the economy. We the old-time conservative religion. And I think that probably helped Mike Pence a great deal for 2020. Whether it helped Mr. Trump or not, I don't know. I mean, the Washington Post has said in the last 2 weeks since the debate, he has, quote, set fire to his own campaign. And here's what the damage is. Just before the debate, two weeks ago, coming up Monday, Hillary Clinton in the 538 scoreboard, which is the Nate Silver website, had a 54% chance of winning the presidency. This morning, 79%.
That is a bounce back up for her. Nancy Youssef, politics not your thing, but you were watching like the rest of us. Put yourself in the every woman's seat here. What did you make of this debate?
Well, I couldn't help but be fascinated by Pence's comments on Russia and on Syria because it was such a divergence from what we've heard from Donald Trump. He called Putin a bullying leader, where Trump has called him a strong leader. And also, he advocated for more potential U.S. military intervention in Syria. He called for creating safe zones, which arguably would require military intervention. He said that the U.S. should show American strength should the Russians continue to help the Assad regime conduct strikes and attacks in eastern Aleppo. And so it was quite a split from what we had heard from Donald Trump on foreign affairs, on the war in Syria, and on the potential for U.S.-Russian relations going forward. Pence mocked the idea of a reset that the Obama administration had tried earlier, and at the same time essentially was countering the Trump narrative of a reset of sorts, that the U.S. and the Russians should get along better. So from a foreign policy perspective, it was very interesting because it was hard to know where the Republican slate was on the key issues of U.S.-Russia relations and the ongoing war in Syria.
A more conventional, maybe traditional, tough stance on Russia. That got more interesting this week as the U.S. and Russia fell out of their pretty fragile, weak peace talks anyway, but began to talk in a kind of huffy way over Syria, made the Mike Pence's comments on Monday night even more interesting in retrospect. Here he was, went beyond what Donald Trump has said the U.S. should be prepared to use military force in Syria.
I just have to tell you that the provocations by Russia need to be met with American strength. And if Russia chooses to be involved and continue, I should say, to be involved, and this barbaric attack on civilians in Aleppo, the United States of America should be prepared to use military force to strike military targets of the Assad regime.
Let's stick with this for a moment. We'll come back to politics. But, Nancy, this is in your wheelhouse. And it was the very next day in Brussels. We had Secretary of State John Kerry really going after the Russians and breaking this sort of what had seemed like a pretty thin facade of talks anyway. Russians coming back later in the week saying, look, we've got anti-aircraft missiles in there and they've got more range than you might guess. Be careful where you kind of implicit was. Be careful where you fly American Air Force. But here was Kerry in Brussels going after Russia.
In sorrow, and I have to tell you with a great sense of outrage, that Russia has turned a blind eye to Assad's deplorable use of these weapons of war.
Nancy Youssef, are we edging toward the possibility of a U.S.-Russia conflict, even military conflict in Syria?
No, I think what we saw this week is that we are looking at a United States that is not going to intervene in any real way in the potential loss of eastern Aleppo out of opposition hands and back into Assad's hands. You know, Kerry was always the eternal optimist in terms of being able to negotiate with the Russians, I dare say above almost anyone else in the administration. And even he appeared frustrated this week and walked away from the talks. And so the last sort of diplomatic channel was closed. And militarily, you've seen the Obama administration be really reticent to get involved in any way, the feeling being that the U.S. military intervention on behalf of the opposition in eastern Aleppo could have unintended consequences and draw the United States into a proxy war with Russia. And so in the face of all that, you saw some of the most aggressive strikes we've seen in eastern Aleppo by the Russians on civilian targets and Syrian ground forces moving in a real aggressive way. In eastern Aleppo. And so it was a real game changer in terms of the status of Syria's largest city and a statement essentially from the United States that as of now, the diplomatic channels have closed down and there's not a real appetite for looking at military options.
Does that mean Syria is back to Assad, that Russia wins, game over, it's theirs?
Well, everybody has a different prediction. My own personal assessment is that eastern Aleppo is in jeopardy of falling out of opposition hands and going back into regime hands if that happens. And it's unclear if it would happen in a very clean way, right, because this is an insurgency, so you could always have some elements continue to fight there. But assuming that eastern Aleppo is declared back in regime hands and the regime controls Aleppo, there's the potential that the same tactic of seize and starve cities could expand to other opposition-held areas like the suburbs of Damascus, which is this sort of prevailing feeling of where this kind of warfare could go next. What happens in these kinds of wars, because urban areas are so hard to reclaim, the Assad regime has basically tried to drive people out by hitting things like hospitals and bakeries and food and water supplies. And I think the fear is that that kind of tactic will expand to other parts of Syria, and these horrific images that we've seen in Aleppo happening in other parts of the country.
Absolutely terrible. Mark Murray, bring it back home to the politics. What about foreign policy and how it plays? Mike Pence on Monday night, going beyond Donald Trump on the appearance of a threat to get the U.S. involved militarily. If we go into January with the U.S. and Russia at this kind of open break over Syria, how does that look? And what about the political weight of these arguments? Do they matter in this race, Mark?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Nancy made a great point about the debate between Mike Pence and Tim Kaine and how Pence really did break from Donald Trump. And putting it in purely in a political lens, Donald Trump really hasn't been consistent on a lot of policy matters. But one area where he has been entirely consistent has been when it comes to Russia and when it actually has come to his views on Vladimir Putin. And given that Mike Pence had a fundamentally different view of Russia and its involvement in Syria than Donald Trump does, this is going to end up having legs heading into Sunday's debate with Hillary Clinton. I wouldn't be surprised if she brings that up and really tries to put Donald Trump on the defensive when it comes to Russia, Putin, and how antithetical a lot of Russia's aims are, particularly in Syria, versus United States interest. And then even beyond that, too, I think any time that the issue of Russia is raised does put Donald Trump on the defensive. Our NBC Wall Street Journal poll a couple of times this year has been able to look at Vladimir Putin's polling ratings among American voters, and he is incredibly unpopular with most Americans. And so I do think that every time that we end up talking about Russia, that Donald Trump has to talk about Russia is not very good. Now, as far as what goes on in January...
Mark, hold that thought. We're going to take a short break right here. We'll come back to January. We'll come back to November. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Hurricane evacuation, VP debate, the NSA breach, a kind of U.S.-Russia breakdown, and a peace prize after no peace in Colombia. Nobel Peace Prize for President Santos there. Mark Murray is with us, senior political editor for NBC News. Nancy Youssef is here, senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. Our own Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. Are you running from Hurricane Matthew today? Are you warm and dry? Are you in trouble? And how does the presidential race look with a month to go? 1 month to go. Did Pence break Trump's fall the last 10 days? Did Kaine help Clinton? What do you still need to see here Sunday night? The day after the Wednesday, I guess, night in Philadelphia, Tim Kaine acknowledged that he'd taken a few criticisms here, said Mike Pence did not really stand up for the top of his ticket, Donald Trump.
I got dinged a little bit, even by my wife, for, like, interrupting too much. Okay. But the key part of that debate was, at some points, I felt like both me and Mike Pence were debating Donald Trump. I was going after Donald Trump, and Mike Pence kind of was going after Trump with me. And I can't imagine that made the Donald too happy.
Yes, there looked like there was some distance there, but Donald Trump said real happy with it. Here he was in Nevada after the debate.
Mike Pence did an incredible job, and I'm getting a lot of credit because that's really my first so-called choice. That was my first hire, as we would say in Las Vegas.
Trump will be in the town hall on Sunday night with Hillary Clinton. Joseph in Memphis, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, Joseph. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty good.
What I see is basically, as far as Mr. Kaine and Mr. Pence are concerned, basically I see a problem there with him trying to diffuse Mr. Pence's message and Donald Trump's superior negotiating skills, basically. And what I generally see is a problem with Mr. Pence being interrupted. That's a technique of diffusion. And as you see, the correct statistical quote would be 92 times, which isn't statistics. He interrupted him 92 times. that's diffusion. He tries to diffuse his message and take him off.
Do you think Mike Pence got things back on beam here, Joseph? It sounds like you're a Trump supporter. Do things look better to you after the debate?
Of course I am. Of course I am. I believe that Donald Trump is an excellent presidential candidate, and basically he needs to be the president of the United States. He speaks to the American people in their heart and soul, and he's tired of the political games played in Washington, D.C. on the American people.
Joseph, we've got it. I've got a lot more, but we've got it right there. Strong for Mike Pence and strong for Donald Trump. Cut out the games. We've got it, Joseph. One more right here. Thank you. For Springfield, Illinois. J.D., you're on.
Morning, Tom. I decided to do what I'd heard 56 years ago, Nixon and Kennedy debating, and how Nixon won it on the radio and Kennedy won it on television.
Okay.
I decided to watch the vice presidential debate on the radio.
Okay.
I didn't watch it.
Watch it on the radio. And what difference did that make, J.D.? How did it sound?
And I thought Senator Kaine won the radio debate. And I don't know how he did on television because I didn't see it.
That leaves us to work out the theatrics. But if you listen on the radio, J.D. in Springfield says... He'll hand it to Tim Kaine. Jack, come in here. We've got Memphis saying strong for Trump right there. Radio listener who might have missed some of that kind of grimacing faces that Tim Kaine was making. And sounded good to him on the radio. What about, I mean, you've always got, what is it, the semiotics, the theatrics of it, Jack?
Right. And I think Pence's reassuring pace and baritone and so on, all of that for television viewers made him more plausible. Almost every poll I've seen showed him winning hands down. But on substance, on factual accuracy, on the cut and thrust of debate, I would hate to be in a law court against Tim Kaine. I think Kaine came out ahead. You know, Mark mentioned the issue of Russia and the gap that that Pence opened on policy in Syria vis-a-vis Russia with Mr. Trump. That makes somewhat ironic the only newspaper endorsement for Mr. Trump that I've been able to find, and that is in the National Enquirer, which in March wrote a glowing Trump must be president editorial. And one of the reasons they gave 10 reasons, but one of them, only Trump has the guts to stand up to foreign leaders like Vladimir Putin and gain their respect. Looks a little ironic in view of Mr. Trump's deference, to say the least, to Mr. Putin.
I mean, standing up to Putin has not exactly been Donald Trump's big thing. No, that's true. David in Providence, Rhode Island. David, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Great to be here. I just really want to comment about how people are giving Mike Pence praise for being able to lie with a straight face and look good doing it. When you, if anything, you should be attacking him. His most egregious lie during the debate was that neither he nor Donald Trump would ever put a woman in jail for having an abortion, which is an absolute lie, because there's a woman who was sentenced to 20 years in prison for giving herself an abortion, Purvi Patel. And why the media hasn't pounced on that egregious lie just really appalls me.
I don't know that particular case, David, but many pointed out that Tim Kaine was presenting, of course, phrased in a way to enhance political advantage, things that Donald Trump had said and Mike Pence either denied or demurred, declined to really tangle over it. Mark Murray, the thing the next morning was Pence won't defend Trump. Does that stand up?
It does, and it stood up 24 hours after the debate and 48 hours after. And I, Tom, say that the conversations and calling-ins from Joseph, J.D., and David all kind of encapsulate my thoughts on the vice presidential debate. And so Joseph is actually right that Mike Pence's style was superior on TV. And it is worth noting, Tom, that Mike Pence is a former radio host. And so he was incredibly smooth, very assured, very calm. And I think that one of the reasons why some of the robo-dials and the polls ended up showing that Pence came out ahead. But then you end up having the situation where J.D. is right as well, that the big memory that you end up having 24 hours, 48 hours, is Tim Kaine litigating against Mike Pence and Donald Trump. To me, that still is the story that stands out after the debate. And then to David's point, when it comes to the fact-checking, that Mike Pence, you know, as we were able to chronicle at least three times, ended up saying something that wasn't true, that he ended up denying saying, or that he or Tim or Donald Trump had said something, and the tape had shown something else. And so to me, I'm so glad that you ended up having those three callers, because I think that and it really epitomizes what ended up happening at that debate on Tuesday.
I want to hear from Hillary Clinton for a moment, but I also want to keep Hurricane Matthew fully in mind here. I mean, this is still a big thing. 500,000 now without power, we're reading from the Weather Channel here. Death toll in Haiti up toward 600 at this point. They're talking about catastrophic impacts there. And, of course, in the United States, lots of people evacuated. We've got a call from Elizabeth, who's just been, I think, dumped off of a Caribbean cruise in Tampa because of the storm. Elizabeth, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, thanks, Tom. My daughter, young daughter, and I were on a cruise down. We got diverted from the Cayman Islands and went to Cozumel, and then came back with the, the Coast Guard said the hurricane was nipping at our heels.
Yep.
And when we landed in Tampa, or ported in Tampa, all of our flights out of Orlando had been canceled, and we had the option to stay in Orlando and wait it out, which, I'm a mainlander. I had no desire to do that. So my 8-year-old daughter and I rented a car, and we are driving from Orlando to St. Louis, Missouri.
Headed home and getting well inland away from that storm. We'll turn again to the storm, but I just want to keep it in mind as we talk about everything else, because so many people now have moved away from the coast, and Hurricane Matthew still having its impact in a big way. We haven't heard from Hillary Clinton at all yet here. Let's hear just a little bit of her. This was on Toledo, in Toledo, Ohio, on Monday as things geared up. And she was still thinking about the big story about Trump's taxes, that almost billion-dollar loss that New York Times and others then were speculating could have meant he would not have to pay taxes for 18 years or something like that. Maybe he hasn't. Hillary Clinton is happy to say, because he won't put his tax returns out, so we don't know. We don't know. But here she was in Toledo.
Doesn't look like he paid a dime of federal income tax for almost two decades. Now, while millions of American families, including mine and yours, were working hard, paying our fair share, it seems he was contributing nothing to our nation.
Nothing to our nation. Mark Murray, how does this race look at this point? Here we are. It's 1 month tomorrow to November 8th.
It looks right now you'd rather be Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. And you wouldn't have said that 2 or 3 weeks ago, particularly after the news of Hillary Clinton battling pneumonia, being off the campaign trail, some of the polls in Donald Trump's favor. But pretty much after that debate, almost all the news has been in Hillary Clinton's favor, whether it's the polls, whether it was some of the investigative pieces like the New York Times report. When it comes to that 1995 Donald Trump tax return. To me, the biggest story isn't that Donald Trump hasn't probably paid federal taxes over the last 18 years. It's that he lost nearly $1 billion in 1995. And for someone who talks about his credentials as a successful businessman, as a job creator, to me, that's the most damaging part, that you end up having someone who wasn't all that successful, number one, then still profited. And as the Times ended up laying out at the same time, you end up having contractors and other people take the hits for the loss. And so that, to me, is the biggest storyline here. When Donald Trump talks about his business credentials making him the perfect person to control and be president of the United States when it comes to the economy, but now Hillary Clinton is able to say, look, back in 1995, you lost $1 billion.
That's a lot of money. He says, I came back. Leon in Odessa, Texas. Leon, you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to say that in watching the debate, I would give Pence style points.
Okay.
But when it comes to substance, there was no substance to what Pence was saying. Consequently, I ruled it more or less as a tie. And that's my opinion.
There's a verdict.
I don't think. Go ahead, sir.
No, I think we've got it. So what do you think comes out of that, Leon? If it's a tie, what's it mean for the race?
Well, what it means for the race is that the Clinton administration, or the Clinton campaign, is probably going to come out the winner, and has come out the winner as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we'll have another round to look at on Sunday night. And, of course, yes, in some polls it's looking better for her in the last couple of weeks. Leon, I appreciate your call. We're looking at a week in the news, hurricane bearing down on the U.S. after sweeping across the Caribbean, and a lot more.
lots of newspapers coming out. National Enquirer, you say, Jack, for Donald Trump. I hadn't seen that. I have seen this huge drumbeat, though, coming out in the other direction. Washington Post really coming in hard and strong this week on its editorial page, which is not a particularly liberal editorial page, but against Trump, saying, you know, just cannot, must not do it. They say Washington Post editorial says he despises the press, threatens his enemies, bullies the judiciary, disparages entire religions and nations, makes no distinction between his personal interests and the public good, hides information that should be revealed, routinely trades in falsehoods. They write, handed the immense powers of the presidency, what could such a man do? The honest answer, no one can be sure. Nancy Youssef, you're there in Washington. This was a whole string of editorials that they came out with. This is their concluding no to Trump from the Washington Post. Did that make a ripple in Washington, Nancy?
Well, I feel like the ripples already happened because this is a industry town. Our industry is government, and whoever comes in, the personality and their style really shapes this town. The Washington Post in particular, I found, has been really aggressive in sort of going after the Trump campaign, looking for documents, going after tax records, going after his charities. And to me, the editorial page really was a reflection of a commitment that the Washington Post has had towards investigating Donald Trump. And so while it was surprising in the sense that this the editorial page is not usually considered liberal, it was on track of months and months of coverage of going into detailed reporting about Trump's record, Trump's finances, in a way that I don't think any other print publication has dedicated resources towards.
They wrote, we have faith ultimately in the integrity of the federal workforce, the resilience of the U.S. system, the essential fairness of the American people, but all three could be tested as never before by a Trump presidency. The nation should not subject itself to such a risk. Well, okay, it's one paper's opinion, but it's right there, a paper that's not usually terribly liberal. Interesting this week, Bill Clinton and Mike Pence quoted him on this, talking about the craziest thing about the Obamacare program. He was in Flint, Michigan. This was on Monday. Criticized the Affordable Care Act for saturating the health insurance market and driving up costs for middle-class Americans. Bill Clinton.
So you've got this crazy system where all of a sudden 25 million more people have health care, and then the people are out there busting it sometimes 60 hours a week, wind up with their premiums doubled and their coverage cut in half. It's the craziest thing in the world.
Craziest thing in the world. Jack, what about, I mean, he looked to backtrack very quickly in Athens, Ohio, the next day. He said, look, it's the did a world of good, the Affordable Health Care Act, and Republicans would be very wrong to try and repeal it. But what about the Bill Clinton swipe at Obamacare situation?
Well, one could feel that Bill is losing his fastball. You know, he was talking there about a small group of people. This is according to reporting by Jonathan Combe, really one of the best healthcare reporters. People who make just a little too much money to qualify for the benefits in the assistance in the program, and nothing, and they have a real problem. They're just getting clobbered with high deductibles, high bills. Combe says that Hillary Clinton has a quote, combination of policies that in theory would address and fix this problem, and point to editorials in medical journals written by both President Obama and Hillary Clinton that concede these shortcomings and say, in a Clinton administration, we will fix them. Well, that's, of course, pending congressional assistance. But the former president did praise the law's accomplishments, 20 million people on health insurance and bringing the uninsured rate to historic low. This was one comment, though, that I'm sure that he did, in fact, call back.
Town hall style encounter with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on Sunday night with regular citizens in the audience putting the questions. Mark Murray, who does that setting favor, to your mind?
The advantage goes to Hillary Clinton. She has had so many more town halls during the entirety of this presidential campaign than Donald Trump has. It's worth noting that Donald Trump, typically, when he goes campaigning, it's big rallies, big airport hangars, enthusiastic crowds. Hillary Clinton has had mainly, she has done a lot more retail politics than those big rallies. And so that gives her the advantage. Now, Donald Trump was trying to get some practice on Thursday night in New Hampshire. One of his new debates debate coaches is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who has a lot of practice in town halls, particularly when he was running for the presidency, when he camped out in New Hampshire. But the problem that Donald Trump ended up having was that last night's town hall practice, one, was invitation only, and two, the people who ended up asking the questions were all big fans. And that's going to be a different dynamic that he'll face on Sunday night.
Mark, hold the thought there. We got a break right in front of us again. I apologize. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, as Hurricane Matthew approached, some Florida businesses jacked up their prices. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi cried foul.
During a state of emergency, you cannot substantially raise prices, whether it's a hotel room, fuel, commodities, and that's what these bad people are doing, and it's hurting our good citizens in a time of need when they are the most vulnerable.
Lots of vulnerability today. In New York, Kanye West abruptly stopped performing when he got the news his wife Kim Kardashian had been robbed at gunpoint in Paris.
I'm sorry, there's a family emergency. I have to stop the show.
What?
And Chin Thi Nho, better known as Hanoi Hannah, a North Vietnamese radio propagandist during the Vietnam War, well known to American troops for encouraging them to give up the fight, then died at 87. Here she was in wartime way back when.
Defect, D.I. It is a very good idea to leave a sinking ship. You know you cannot win this war.
And you. We're looking at a week in the news, hurricane evacuation, VP debate, the NSA breach, U.S.-Russia breakdown over Syria, peace prize after no peace in Colombia, with Nancy Youssef, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. Senior political editor for NBC News, Mark Murray, is with us. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us as well. What do you make of the leak or hoarding story out of the NSA? Are you getting worried about the U.S. and Russia maybe colliding over Syria? And does Colombia's Santos deserve the Nobel Peace Prize, even though his people did not vote for the peace that he brokered? I want to look at this very interesting NSA story, but just a wrinkle that ties into the election before we do. Here was a press conference on Tuesday. This was in London, of necessity, where WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy there, announced new leaks that he's planning for the days ahead. He said what these documents might address.
Our upcoming series include significant material on war, on arms, on oil, on Google, on the U.S. election, and on mass surveillance.
Okay, pretty muddy there, but there's WikiLeaks, and they have swung a big stick here, even with him there holed up in the embassy, saying they got significant material on war, on arms, on oil, on Google, on the U.S. election. Nancy Youssef, I want to turn and look at the NSA leak or hoarding story, but first, what about this? Is there anything known? Does WikiLeaks believe to have the goods to drop a big October surprise here?
Well, nobody really knows because in that same press conference, if you will, Julian Assange said that they would be releasing material over the next 10 weeks, well past the election. And he suggested that if he had an October surprise, he certainly wouldn't release it at 3 a.m. when this video conference happened. It's an interesting question. Is Julian Assange trolling the election or is the American electorate sort of putting its own biases into his statements and reading things that aren't there? It's a very hard thing to say. When he announced this, he said it was to mark the 10-year anniversary of WikiLeaks, and it was indeed that. But in the run-up to it, there was so much anticipation about what could be revealed, what couldn't be revealed, what effect it could have on the election, that I think there was a lot of expectation that was put on. And the question becomes, who put that expectation on there? But it's very hard to say because they keep sort of there's a looming threat there of something coming out well into the end of the year.
I mean, they sure shook things up during the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, no question about that. I want to turn to the NSA as well. The news came out this week, Harold T. Martin III, 51 years old, Navy veteran, been working in the NSA operation through Booz Allen Hamilton for a long time, and apparently had been taking highly classified material out violating basic security rules since the late 1990s, we're now being told. And they got onto this because they were seeing things come out in public, the NSA, I guess, that were not part of the Edward Snowden trove of leaks. What is the story here now? Is this a Snowden 2, Nancy, or is this now he's being depicted as kind of just a hoarder? What's going on?
It's a great question. So in August, the FBI, according to neighbors, stormed his house wearing military gear. They grab him out of the house again 2 months ago. And in the trunk of his car, they find thousands of documents and computer equipment and documents dating back to before Snowden. And as you mentioned, they were documents that had could have been related to what has been leaked so far. And yet nobody can make a connection in terms of what happened precisely. There's sort of a there's a lot of smoke, but there's no fire yet. It's not clear. There's nothing to show that he gave it away, sold it, that it ended up accidentally. And the depictions that you're hearing of is of a man who I dare say was sort of a geek and liked to collect documents and might have been working on his PhD thesis. The fact that we don't have an answer, even though he's been in FBI custody for 2 months, says that there's a lot more digging to do. That said, something drew them to this man. And so it's right now sort of clouded in mystery, but either way, it has rattled a national security community that is already still reeling from the Edward Snowden leaks and had hoped that it had put a stop to this.
Well, if it's not Harold Martin, then what's going on? I mean, these leaks are out there. The Times reporting that there have been these leaks on techniques used by the NSA to break into foreign computer systems and networks, even if they're not connected to the Internet. This sounds like very sensitive stuff that's being leaked. If it's not Harold Martin and it's not Edward Snowden, what is going on?
Well, the problem is it could be somebody else entirely. And so you see this sort of desperate attempt to try to figure out the source of this because these programs are really top secret and were designed to hack into foreign governments of some of the U.S.'s biggest adversaries, potentially Russia, North Korea. And so if it's not Harold Martin, who was responsible for them, then you have the potential of a still unknown source. And so that's why you see a lot of angst around this arrest and what it means. And yet it's just clouded in uncertainty in terms of what the damage was done, how it was done, or if it was done at all. And this was just somebody who was collecting classified documents. I mean, in the affidavit, he acknowledges that he did something wrong, but there's nothing in there to suggest that that information moved in some way. And so that's why it's so unclear.
The administration talking in a rather cloudy way about it themselves. This was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest talking just yesterday. See how vague.
It's not clear in this situation whether these alleged crimes were committed because the rules weren't being effectively followed, or if there was a creative way for getting around the rules.
We'll just have to stand by on what we learn about Harold T. Martin III and that huge stash of classified material in his backyard kind of tool shed there. Ryan in Moline, Illinois. Thank you for calling, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love the show. I just wanted to mention with Paul Ryan meeting with Donald Trump over the weekend, it just seems like Republicans are having it both ways or more than two ways with we're with Trump, we're against Trump. They secretly are backdoor, you know, having conversations. What are they talking about? It just seems like the Republicans have turned from the party of no during the Obama administration into the party of basically lies. I guess they feel like the demographics are slipping away from them. It's kind of their last opportunity to get something done. And all the lying just kind of coincides with the, you know, the fallacy that climate change isn't real. All their interests are with big oil. You know, they're kind of getting it done for themselves. They're not helping out the American people.
We've got the perspective, Jack.
Yeah, if I may, Paul Ryan put out a media advisory. Paul Ryan will attend the annual Fall Fest in Walworth County. That's how it begins. Three paragraphs down, you get, so will Donald Trump. It's sort of burying it.
Well, it's a big deal after the cool distance that they had for such a long
time.
Yes,
indeed. And you know, just a sense of the distance, Ryan, over since the Trump has been the nominee and before, he's criticized Trump and or the campaign for, quote, really, this is a good summary, joking that someone could shoot Hillary Clinton, for anti-Semitism, for racism, for insulting a gold star mother, for praising Saddam Hussein, and for associating with white supremacists. Those are all things Paul Ryan has criticized Mr. Trump for, but tomorrow they're campaigning, and the announcement of Trump's presence is a kind of whisper in the media advisory.
Mark Murray, what about how the Republicans are dealing with this? We saw Bill Kristol, I saw him tweeting, as Hurricane Matthew bears down, that he was fantasizing. Hurricane hits Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's palace on the shore. They're hard. Trump's so upset he pulls out of the debate Sunday. Mike Pence steps in. You can feel the thirst for the more Pence style in many parts of the GOP, the Pence style Republican to be up front, but he's not. It's Trump. So where's the party?
The party is still divided, and I think Ryan, the caller, made a very good point that in some ways Republicans are still trying to have it both ways, and even Paul Ryan himself. Like, sometimes you're going to appear with Donald Trump, and other times you'll hit him on the hand and scold him. But Sunday, to me, is a make-or-break moment for Donald Trump and also for the Republican Party, because if Donald Trump has another poor performance and a similar type of performance we saw in that first debate, you are probably going to see many Republicans cut bait and start sounding the alarms that they need to take care of themselves.
Really? I mean, really? If it doesn't look like he's on a winning path here, but they don't want to lose the White House if they have a chance at it.
They don't. And by cutting bait and abandoning ship, I mean that all of these Republicans will end up saying that, you know what, we need a check on Hillary Clinton, where you would end up, one of the big messages for Republicans in Senate, gubernatorial, but particularly Senate and House races, would end up saying, please elect me because we need to have a check on Hillary Clinton.
Save the majorities if they can, instead of going all out for the nominee?
Correct. And so by saying that, that's actually a big admission to many people that, one, Donald Trump's going to lose the presidential election, but polling often suggests that when people have the option to check another political party, that they like that. And so that has always been the Republicans' break glass type of move if the polls were looking very bad. And I do think that this Sunday debate is a key moment on that Republicans either basically abandon ship and say, I'm going to end up having this message on we need to have a check on Hillary Clinton, or do they stay on this ship because Donald Trump does better than expected. And that, to me, is going to be a very big inflection point. We're already seeing the polls move in one direction, the battleground maps. Sunday's debate is so important to how this rest of the story on Republican unity plays out.
Dan in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey there, Tom. I watched part of the debate. I didn't get to see the whole thing, but I thought Pence was very weak in defending Trump. And I thought Kane did a great job of defending Hillary, about the email, the classified information mishandling and all. I thought Pence did make some great points about Syria, though, the tragedy that's going on over there. And, this isn't a year or two. We're, 5 years in. And, the Obama administration, Hillary's been right in the thick of it. And
yep.
What do we have to show for it?
It's a good question and an important one, Jack. And Pence he pointed to this and said, look, you want a mess? There's a mess. Now, it's complicated, but still, we've had 8 years of President Obama and Hillary Clinton right in the middle of that.
We have. And, the press has said we don't have leverage. Secretary Kerry has said we don't have leverage. But we do. If you look at the big picture, we have the sanctions on Russia over its incursion into Ukraine and its annexation of the Crimea. Those sanctions are hurting the economy. Mr. Putin has put something on the board here, force in Syria. If we want him to stop using force and perhaps to help arrange a settlement, we have something we could trade off. those sanctions. And it's strange enough, it's the kind of thought that might occur to a realist in foreign policy, but also to someone who's sort of Putin-friendly, like Donald Trump. And because, it, you know, surely it would be embarrassing and all the rest. But nobody thinks that Crimea is ever going to go back to Ukraine. And so the sanctions have sort of, how long they're going to continue, we don't know. But it is strange that hasn't even been addressed.
Oh, Anne in Elm Grove, Wisconsin. Anne, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Two quick points going back to the debate. I think Kane clearly won, because truth will always win out over appearance. Kane's content was, for the most part, true. Pence was all smoke and mirrors and denial of the truth. And my other point is this. I was a bit disappointed in the fact that Kane never brought out the true nature of Pence's radical far-right positions on social issues. I wonder if most Americans realize his positions on gay rights, religious freedom, and the mess he created in Indiana as governor.
And, of course, there is a big record on that front. I don't know when that's going to get its full airing. Mike Pence may have his eye on 2020. Maybe we'll hear more about it as he heads there, more from him as well. I appreciate your call, Anne. Nancy, we had the Nobel Peace Prize announcement. Let's just listen again. This is for the President of Colombia.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2016 to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos for his resolute efforts to bring the country's more than 50-year-long civil war to an end.
And Nancy, ironic or a way of honoring a man who tried that this came pretty much in the same week as the country voted against adopting the peace path?
Well, you know, it's such an interesting story. This was a man who was defense minister at a time when one of the peak times that Colombia was going after the FARC, started these talks unofficially 2010, officially 2012, 4 years ago, reached these talks and were so celebrated just recently. And there was this referendum that many saw as perfunctory because the polls were showing that the Colombians would support finally a peace deal after the longest war in the Americas, 52 years going. And the polls were all in favor of a referendum, and they come out and they lose 50% point two. I think this was a award for courage, because I think it took great courage for him to reach out to make this deal and to continue doing so even after the referendum failed.
You don't think it's just because they had the announcement printed up already and couldn't change it?
I think it's to maybe encourage the parties to keep going.
It did and does take courage to stand up for peace sometimes, and we salute the President of Colombia there. But that, at this telling, an unfinished story, even with the Nobel Peace Prize there. That's Nancy right. Youssef, Senior National Security Correspondent for the Daily Beast, is terrific to have you as always. Thank you for joining us today, Nancy.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Mark Murray, Senior Political Editor for NBC News. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, thank you to you.
Thank you.
On the Southeast Coast, stay safe. As Hurricane Matthew comes, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.